Welcome to Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. In school, you were probably taught that you could tell the age of a tree by counting its rings. Well, it turns out that's not quite right, because trees lie about their age. Ecologist Dr. Christian Messier of the Sustainable Forest Management Network says the how and why of this new discovery will change the way companies deal with forest reclamation. And two Alberta researchers have figured out how to spin barley into gold. Savina is a spin-off company at the University of Alberta, which has developed a new technique for separating beta-glucans from barley. A $2 million investment from Foragen will help Savina move from the lab into a pilot plant. And the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow is a $100 million a year business. All this coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. Trees, it turns out, are sneaky beasts. Little spruce languish in the shade under taller sun-loving aspen. Balsam fir even bury themselves underground and creep along in the dark, like Gollum, until they break out into the light of day many years hence. And sometimes they don't even have the decency to produce rings. Of course, all this completely undermines a forester's ability to tell the age of trees. The man behind these revelations is Dr. Christian Messier, a researcher with the Sustainable Forest Management Network. Even he was surprised by the results when he first set out to study why some trees are tolerant of shade.
Actually, I've been interested in this notion of what we call shade tolerance, is how trees grow and develop in shade. And this is actually an observation that has been made a long, long, long time ago, starting even with the Greek philosophers. They realized that some trees were growing in the shade of the forest and some trees were not. And this is a very important aspect for forestry and even for ecology, because we know that the trees that can develop in shade will replace trees that cannot regenerate in shade. And this is what we call succession. So we often have, after fire or what various type of disturbance, what we call shade intolerant species like aspen get established. And under the aspen, you don't have aspen because it's shade intolerant. You have trees that are shade tolerant, and in Alberta it would be white spruce, and in some deciduous forests in eastern Canada it could be sugar maple and western hemlock and American beech and other species. So I was always interested by this notion of shade tolerance, so a lot of my work has been done on this. But then I was interested in how a small trees that actually can tolerate shade becomes a big trees. And I was also very interested in looking at how they adapt and how they change from being 10 centimeter tall to 6 meter and then to 10 meter. And then talking to a colleague that was working in the northern part of the World Forest in Quebec, what he observed was that under some very dark, really dark conifer forest with almost no vegetation, there was this layer of small balsam fir around 10 to 20 centimeters that were all between, as far as he could tell, 15 to 20 years old. There was no small trees, no big trees, and he was wondering how could these trees stay there? It seems forever. They don't become big, and it seems to come out of the blue like magic. So we decided to put a good grad student that was interested in the question. And like we always do, we let this person loose and with these questions. And what actually we found was actually very interesting and very intriguing was that these little trees were not 15 to 20 years old. Some of them were up to 100 years old. And what had happened is that actually these small trees are very flimsy. They have very small diameters. They are so not very structurally very strong. And so when the snow falls on them in the winter, they are pushed on the ground, and these trees have the ability to produce roots when they touch the ground. That's what we call adventurous roots. And so the stem that was actually the part that was above ground that was a stem becomes a root. So the trees maintain itself very small because it continuously do that. It goes on the, it's pushed on the forest floor, produce roots, and then get rid of the old part of the root system underground, and it stays small. So that was an interesting observation. But then we started to ask ourselves, why does it do that? What is the advantage for a tree to prostrate itself and stay small? And then this was actually one of my interests of research was that what I've actually found out, it was that trees that are growing taller require more light, because the taller a tree grows, the more tissues that respire. They actually have more tissues that respire than tissue that can fix light and produce carbon. So that the bigger the trees become, the more light they require. And what we find out was these trees, by staying small, they could survive in these dark understories. If they were not doing this, they will have actually grown bigger, and because light doesn't increase, they will have died. So this was actually, as far as we can tell, a new strategy of shade tolerance that has never been explained before. This ability of trees to stay small and wait for gaps to occur so that they can actually grow and reach the canopy.
Now, you say that some of those trees, which it appeared they were only 15 years old and actually were 100, how could you tell? Usually when you look at a tree, you count the rings to figure out how old it is.
What we find is that actually the tree that is growing in very, very stressful environment, these are very stressful environment, hardly any light, not a lot of water, because the dominant trees actually compete for the water. They actually stop. They don't produce rings some years. They can do that even up to 5 years. No rings at all. And so that's a way for the trees to actually stay small and maintain itself. But then, of course, what we did is when we dig the trees, we found these old stems that were stemmed before that has been buried underground. And we could still see some little scars on the stems where the... Every year there is an elongation in the tree, and then there's little scars. So we can count on these buried stem how old they were when they were buried underneath. And some of them actually had up to 40 years underground. Some of them have another 20 years of missing rings. And if you had around 15 to 20 years that they already were, so we had trees that were 80 to 100 years old.
Is this something that would apply to other trees, or is it something just with this balsam fir?
Well, missing rings, actually, when we dig in the literature, is not something new. I think there is at least 20 species that has been shown of having these missing rings. Maybe the part that is most intriguing is this ability to bury itself and produce adventurous roots and stay small. So far, we know that black spruce does this. We know that white spruce, in some cases, could do this. Hemlock, either the western hemlock or the eastern hemlock, can do this. And then I also work in the deciduous forest in southern Quebec. And sugar maple is also a tree that can do this. And we have started doing a study on sugar maple, and it seems that sugar maple does exactly the same. It actually get pushed by the snow, get buried, and it produced adventurous root, and some trees that we thought were 10 years old are much older than this. So it might actually be a very common process, and we even think that this is probably universal in most forests in the world.
What significance or implications does this finding have now for the way we look at forests and do logging and reforestation?
Well, it has actually lots of implications, because when we look at the literature before, there was a lot of studies and a lot of interpretation about succession that was done that are now, we know, are wrong. Lots of studies have shown that balsam fir, for example, was not able to get established right after a disturbance. It had to wait 20 and 30 years before to get established. Now we know that it's probably wrong. It got established, but we didn't see the first 30 years. They were actually buried underground. We also, lots of studies have actually shown that when there is this spruce budworm epidemic, which is a very, very important epidemic in the balsam fir forest, people were showing that fir was getting established during an epidemic of the spruce budworm, which doesn't make biological sense because the bugs eats the reproductive buds first. So now we know that, again, it was wrong, that the seedlings were not established during the epidemic but before the epidemic. And since the new paradigm in forestry is to develop practices that are emulating natural disturbance, it is very important for us to better understand how these forests regenerate, what are the strategy of the species, so we can actually develop forestry practices that will better emulate nature. So I think that we have to reevaluate a little bit our models of how we will regenerate balsam fir based on these results.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
I was speaking with Dr. Christian Messier. He's a professor of forest ecology at the University of Quebec, and his research is supported by the Sustainable Forest Management Network, which is hosted at the University of Alberta. There's more to barley and oats than horse feed. These grains contain beta-glucans, which have important benefits for people with heart disease and diabetes. Two researchers at the University of Alberta have discovered a better way to separate beta-glucans from the grains. Under the company name Savina Bioproducts, which derives its name from cereal and the Latin term for veins, they are now ready to test their technology in a pilot plant. This will happen thanks to a $2.3 million investment from Foragen Technologies Management and AVAC. Dr. Farrell Tomelli is a professor in the Department of Agriculture, Food, and Nutritional Science at the University of Alberta.
Well, I've been working with barley for the past 10 years when the Alberta Barley Commission first announced that they will be supporting research projects. So at that time, I decided to move into working with barley. So I've been working with barley and beta-glucan for the past 10 years, and this is basically an outcome of 10 years of research, of course, in collaboration with Dr. Vizanthan. And this is the accumulation of the know-how and the expertise and the outcome of that.
The beta-glucan, what's so special about that? What have you discovered?
Well, the beta-glucan is a soluble dietary fiber component. It's a polysaccharide, and it has been shown that it reduces blood cholesterol levels, and it also regulates blood sugar levels. So I guess there is advantages for both heart disease as well as diabetes. So there's definitely a lot of potential in terms of its health benefits.
What is it that you're trying to do then with in commercializing it? What aspect are you looking at?
Well, the main thing we are looking at is to isolate beta-glucan from oats and barley so that it can be incorporated into other food products so that it will be available to the public in a wider variety of products in the levels that will generate these health benefits.
This separation, is that what they call fractionation?
That's right. That's right. The fractionation process we are working on is to be able to separate the grain into its components. Mainly, we are separating the starch and the beta-glucan.
Is it a difficult thing to do, separate these things?
Well, the technology development obviously takes a long time to develop, but in the end, we feel that the technology that we have is a relatively simpler process compared to the traditional processes. So we're hopeful that we have a lot of potential to be able to do this in a cost-effective manner. Yeah.
What is it about the beta-glucan that makes it want to stay in the oats and barley and not come out? What's the big obstacle for you?
Well, the beta-glucan is found in the cell walls of the endosperm part of the grain. So, within the endosperm, we have a mixture of starch protein and beta-glucan. So I think the trick is to be able to separate these components without destroying these components and still maintain their native form.
The media announcements today was to let the world know that you have a big investor. What does this do for you and the research and how you're going to get ahead?
Well, this is obviously a very exciting development for us, and this will, with the investment, we will be able to expand our research program, and we will be able to actually take it to larger scale pilot plant testing, which otherwise we will not be able to do, because as you see in our labs, we are working with small beakers, and to be able to take it to the next level of working with industrial scale equipment, even though it's going to be in small scale, but to be able to work with the industrial equipment, it has its own challenges, so we are moving to that next stage with this big investment, and with our partners we are moving to that next level.
Well, I wish you all the best of luck. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
That was food researcher Dr. Farrell Tomelli. Her fellow inventor and partner in Savina Bioproducts, a University of Alberta spin-off company, is Dr. Thava Vasathan. He's also a professor in the Department of Agriculture, Food, and Nutritional Science.
The traditional approach of selling grains as grains, I mean, that's not a profitable business anymore. The grain utilization perspective has changed a lot in the past decade, and there are a lot of value in grain if you break them or if you separate the individual components of grains and sell them at a higher price. I mean, they have unique properties and functional properties, so it can be applied in food as well as in non-food applications. So when you fractionate and sell, you are increasing the value of the basic grain that you're selling.
What's special or unique, then, about what it is that you're doing?
The cost efficiency of our process is a key here. There are traditional technologies, and the products are available, but they're very high cost, you see. It's not affordable to food industries to get those products and put it into food and get the margin back or the money back, because you have to sell Kellogg's or any cereal packets for more than $6-7. I mean, people are looking for money as well. So it's the cost efficiency and the quality that is the key here. And we have a reasonably good quality product and at an affordable cost. So we are highly hoping that we'll catch the market.
What have you had to do in your research process? What are some of the obstacles or difficulties that you faced?
Initially, I mean, it was started as a hobby in our lab, and when we found something interesting, and when we wanted money to pursue that, and the generous help from Alberta Barley Commission, I really have to acknowledge their contribution here, financial as well as moral support, and also Alberta Agriculture Research Institute, and they funded this research to start, and finance was that we have the expertise here. And we know the technology was going to work, but we didn't have the money. The people who contributed the finance, I mean, should be really acknowledged here.
With the partnership now with Foragen, which has put forward a couple of $1 million, what will that do?
We have done some preliminary testing in the lab, and nearly 1 year of work, I mean, quite a promising results we obtained. And the next test is we have to understand the technicality and the economic feasibility. We have done that in a theoretical basis, but nothing like running in an actual plant or in a pilot plant and checking the actual values of it. And we are quite confident it's going to work very well, but still it should be checked. The pre-pilot scaling we are trying to do in province here, within the province, and for the large-scale pilot testing, we may have to go out of the province. So the investment dollars will be mainly, it's quite an expensive process to go through and to talk to companies who are interested in our products and to work with them to market our product. So the investment dollars are mainly going to be used for this purpose.
When do you expect to see this actually on the market?
If everything goes very well, we can have the product, or at least a sample product, in the market in 1.5 to 2 years.
Well, thank you very much.
Well, thank you. Thanks for coming by.
That was Dr. Thava Vasathan. Both he and Dr. Farrell Tomelli are professors in the Department of Agriculture, Food, and Nutritional Sciences at the University of Alberta. One of the investors to help them get their invention out of the lab and into the market is Foragen Technologies Management, Inc. Dr. Murray McLaughlin is Foragen's president and CEO, and he sees great potential for Savina Bioproducts.
I think when you look at one of these, we're really, truly early seed stage, but I mean, we have to look and project out where these are going to be. And I mean, this is obviously something that can probably create a $100 million a year business or higher over the long term, but you know, it's a number of years down the road before you reach that level. But that's the sort of expectations that we have, because we're obviously, as you said, in the venture capital business, we have to get a return on our investment. So we invest in creating these companies with the expectation of obviously getting a return of 20-30% return on what we invest into this company in the long term.
Now, you've talked about the potential for a financial return in the $100 million range. What is it about the proposal or the technology that you've seen so far in terms of their research that really captured your attention?
Well, I think when you look at the research, and this is, I guess, I've always been in the agricultural industry, and anytime you can look at an opportunity to value add this industry in Canada, and we have to do more of that, this is one of those opportunities. We can take, you know, oats, or we can take barley, and we can do a fractionation system to take some of the higher value products out by fractionation and provide an increased valuation into that product for the province or the country. So we're exporting not just a commodity barley, we're now exporting a fractionated process product that has a much higher value to it. Creates jobs, ensures continue production of barley, doesn't necessarily put more money directly into the hands of the farmers themselves, but it does create jobs in some rural community where we're producing this product, where we're trucking the product to. So there's a number of spin-off opportunities around a technology like this for Canada.
You've provided this seed money. What happens then? Do you just sit back and see where it goes, or do you have a hand in how things develop?
Well, and I guess that's one of the differences with us and a lot of venture funds. We take a very active hands-on approach. Armand Lavoie, who works with us, will be the acting CEO for the first probably 6 or 12 months. During that time period, we'll start looking for a CEO, build that person into place. We help develop the business plan. We help manage the budget. We make sure that the milestones are being met that we lay out at this point, but that's what we're really financing, is the development of these milestones. And once those are done, then you look at, okay, we need to get more money brought in. So how do we raise that additional money? We take a very active role in all of that. So we're really a truly hands-on organization. We invest and manage the business.
With Savina, when do you decide if this is a go or it's not, in terms of following up on the managing, seeing if you've met those milestones and, you know, bringing in new investment?
Well, I think, you know, the money that we've got there now will carry us through probably 18, 24 months. So really over the next 12 months, there's a series of milestones in going through the pilot scale up that are critical. And yeah, there'll be hiccups. There always is hiccups when you do pilot scale up, but that's fine as long as you understand and you can go back and make the corrections. And that's why we need this 12 or 18 months. But probably after about 12 months, we'll have a very comfortable level with this technology. I mean, we're very comfortable with this one already because it is an interesting one. There's truly an opportunity out there in the market side for a beta-glucan type product that will fit into this, what I call the nutraceutical functional food market, the wellness cut type of market. And so the market opportunity is there. And as long as we can continue to show that we can produce this product at the levels we expect and at the valuation that we expect, those are the critical, you know, points that we have to watch. But overall, I'd say I don't see this as something that's going to fail. I mean, we're very, very upbeat and very positive on it, but then you never know.
Thank you very much.
Well, you're welcome.
That was Dr. Murray McLaughlin, President and CEO of Forage and Technologies Management. Along to help celebrate the good news for Savina Bioproducts was Shirley McClellan, Alberta's Deputy Premier and the Minister of Agriculture, Food and Rural Development.
Well, it's exciting. This is another investment in agriculture, in the value-added side, in an area that we've been talking about for some time. And, of course, our research strategy has been emphasizing through Victor Dirksen, our Minister of Science and Innovation, the opportunities that are there in nutraceuticals, functional foods, and non-food uses for agricultural products. So it's exciting for us. We know that the opportunities in value added are there. We know that we have a high quality product. We have excellent research in this province in agriculture. We have AVAC Corporation, which is another part of it. We have, of course, our lending through our own Ag Financial Services Corporation. There are just so many things that are there in agriculture's favor in Alberta to move forward. So when you see it happen, when you see a project move to the next step, the next level, and take it to that opportunity for commercialization, it is very gratifying.
You've spoken about the need for science and research and how important that is to the agricultural industry. Why is that? What changes have you seen over the last 10 or 20 years?
Well, we've seen a lot of changes, and I mentioned a couple of them in my comments today. Thanks to good science and good research, we do have hardier crops. We do have crops that resist pests. We have crops that resist drought. We probably are producing more product this year than we would have in those conditions 25 years ago, strictly because we do have better farming methods, better technologies. But we're seeing, I think, the value-added side of it really grow. I was associate minister some years ago when we set the goal of being at $10 billion in value-added in 10 years. And I think there was some skepticism at that time, but here we are. So we know the opportunities are there, and we know the quality is there to develop those opportunities. You need good science, you need good research, and researchers such as the talented people that you've met today here that have that commitment.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Cheryl. It's good to see you again.
That was Shirley McClellan, Alberta's Deputy Premier and the Minister of Agriculture, Food and Rural Development. I also spoke with Dr. Murray McLaughlin of Foragen and researchers Dr. Farrell Tomelli and Dr. Thava Vasathan. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. You can listen to past programs on our website at innovationalberta.com. You can also subscribe to the weekly Innovation Alberta newsletter. The program is sponsored by the Sustainable Forest Management Network, Alberta Pacific Forest Industries, True North Energy, Japan Canada Oil Sands Limited, the University of Lethbridge, the Alberta Conservation Association, the Health Sciences Association of Alberta, the Alberta Research Council, Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research, and the National Institute for Nanotechnology. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Croucher.